Hello, podcast listeners. As you may have noticed, we are living in troubled times. But in times like these, mankind has always turned to the heavens for help.
And that's why we created our podcast, God vs. God. In each episode, we pit two ancient gods against each other to see who has what it takes to come out of retirement and help save us all.
This season, we're exploring wild tales of Greco-Roman deities, their lives and loves, the triumphs and tragedies.
From the Titans to the Olympians, from the King of the Gods to the God of Beekeeping, their stories are bizarre, surprising, and often we think quite funny, but mostly bizarre.
The final episodes of the season are just weeks away, so now's the time to catch up.
Listen to God vs. God on your favorite podcast platform, and as always,
may the best God win.
Let's do it. Let's commence, which is French for start. This week we are talking about... I have to do the intro first. Gosh, what am I doing?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Bonjour and bienvenue to Battle Royale, where we are passing judgment on all of the kings and emperors of France, from Clovis to Napoléon III.
Who will be selected as the crème de la crème? And who will be sent to the guillotine?
Je m'appelle Hercule Poirot. No, je m'appelle Ben Clark.
And I'm Eliza Summers. I was thinking about doing a French accent when I was doing the creme de la creme, and I was like, nah, that'll just be offensive to all the French people out there, that they'll probably guillotine me.
Well, I was doing Poirot, who's not French, he's Belgian. So, who are we doing today?
We are doing another Louis.
Another Louis, although it's the first Louis in a while.
It's been a while, I know, but it's, you know, it's another in the long list of Louis that there will be overall. A halfway Louis.
First non-Carolingian Louis.
One quarter Louis in the list.
Sure. I'm trying to think how many Louis are there.
What, 17, 18, 17?
We're about...
16. I know this.
Again, it depends on who's counting, because there are a couple that are disputed. Towards the end. But I think we're about a third of the way through the Louis.
Okay. Yay, one third way through the Louis.
Or just under a third. Yeah. So, Louis the Sixth is most often colloquially known as Louis the Fat.
Oh my God, that makes me think of, oh my God, Princess Diaries, and the cat's name is Fat Louis.
Fat Louis. Fat Louis. We won't call him Fat Louis the whole time, because he's not fat the whole time. I will say that. He's more of a later life
thing. It's always towards the end, isn't always it, towards of their the life? End.
We're seeing a trend.
Then again, it's understandable. Most people seem to do get, like, a bit more plumper towards the end.
Especially if they have the diet of a medieval king. I'll just say that.
True, true.
Where it's just, like, meat and bread.
Meat.
And
that's it. Good diet.
Vegetables are for peasants.
What about potatoes? Even I suppose that's the most ultimate peasant food,
they didn't
food,
have potatoes.
It?
Didn't have potatoes.
Oh, right, they didn't.
America
such a sad
discovered.
Thought.
They didn't have potatoes. They didn't have tomatoes. Corn. They didn't have half the root vegetables we have. Pretty much like turnips, and that's about it.
Did they have carrots?
And carrots. They had carrots. But the carrots are for animals.
Yeah, their carrots were purple.
They weren't for lords.
Human.
Yeah. So anyway.
Well, that just made me seem as though peasants weren't humans.
Freudian slip there from Eliza's private school upbringing.
Peasants don't exist nowadays, Benjamin.
Unless you go to private school and then you think everyone else is a peasant.
All right. That's terrible.
So, I have lots of notes for Louis VI, so we should get straight into it.
Yes.
Except for the ooh-la-la category, which is not to say that there's no ooh-la-las, just to say that it's kind of sprinkled throughout. So, Eliza, your job is to keep track of the ooh-la-las, as
okay.
usual.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's my favourite part. It's one thing I do keep track of, really.
Yeah. So, in Louis VI's life story, we're going to pretty closely follow his biography by his good friend, Suger, the abbot of Saint-Denis, who is a big deal in terms of both the written record in this period and the government itself. Like, he's helping run the government. He's kind of like the right-hand man of the king at one point. He's also the first medieval text that I ever read.
Oh.
I did a source analysis on him in the first year of uni. I did like a Middle Ages course. Mm. So shout out to first year Middle Ages course at the University of Sydney. And I met you at the same time I was reading Suja.
Aww. So
full circle.
Yeah.
It was a different class, obviously, but...
Yeah.
Because we met in the Greek myth course.
Yes.
Full
special
circle.
Special place in our heart. Moment.
Yeah, so yeah, Louis VI and Abbot Suja have a special place in my heart. But let's first get to know Suja a little bit, because he's going to be the guy that we're going to mostly be seeing Louis's reign through the eyes.
Yeah.
So Suja and Louis were around the same age, born around 1181. But they were unlikely friends because they were the complete opposite of each other. Louis was this like big, robust, handsome prince, while Suja describes himself as a scrawny, short little man of very humble origins. He's quite self-deprecating, actually. There's an entire chapter about how he doesn't deserve to be abbot of Saint-Denis. About how he's so unworthy.
He sounds adorable.
Yeah, he is adorable. Suja was probably not, like, dirt poor, because his family would have had to pay, like, some kind of fee to get him into the Abbey of Saint-Denis, where he learned all his stuff. So he was educated there and managed to network a number of clerical roles, traveling around France and even Italy. And he even attended on a couple popes.
Cool.
So, and over the course of this, his work, he met and befriended Prince Louis, the future Louis VI. And in spite of his eventual status as the king's most trusted advisor and basically prime minister, Suja had no official title, apart from his abbot role. And he took his vows of poverty very seriously. So instead of enriching himself, he enriched the Abbey of Saint-Denis. Which kind of reaches its most splendid state in this period.
Nessness.
Yeah, Suja rebuilds it to be more sort of splendiferous. but like Suja himself, he kept no furniture in the tiny cell where he lived, except for the bed of straw
Slept on a bed of straw. Oh, I basically got it right then. I was more imagining a mound of hay.
Yeah.
I don't even get a proper mattress, mound of hay.
Yeah. And of course, he later becomes a saint, so a lot of this is kind of myth-making around him, but, you know, it's a good image to have of this little, humble little abbot in the middle of this splendid cathedral and royal court and everything.
Yeah, just in humble little clothing.
Yeah, but he's, like, the real one sort of running things as well.
Oh, the kingdom.
Behind the scenes. And making the historical record, which is an even more important job. Because it's what we now know. Yeah. So, yeah, presumably he had a desk, at least, because he was very busy running the country and writing its history. So that being said, now that we know who Suja is, let's rewind a bit back to Louis's birth.
Yes.
So Louis VI had been born around, I said 1181 before, 1081, getting a bit ahead of ourselves, to Philip...
Just some time travelling there.
Yeah, he reigned. I think the last reign I accidentally said, one of us accidentally said 11 when we met 10, and we were like, he's reigning backwards? He's Benjamin Button?
Yeah, that's me.
Maybe. So, yeah, so Louis VI had been born around 1081 to Philip I of France and his wife Bertha of Holland.
Yes.
Do you remember what their situation was?
Not so great.
Not so great. He didn't like that she was fat.
Yeah.
Even though he was fat. Yes. Etymology. Let's get into etymology. Because, I mean, we've already done the etymology for Louis. It means...
Some people might have forgotten.
It means glorious something.
glorious something.
But it's the first... He's the first Louis we've met who isn't a Carolingian, as we said before. So, yeah, the last Louis to be king of France was Louis V, the teenage king who didn't last a year. At the very end of the Carolingians.
Oh, yeah.
And the last Louis that we met in our narrative was his cousin Louis of Lorraine, who died at Mont-Saint-Michel. He was the very last Carolingian. So, last two Louis weren't very glorious figures. So, naming his son Louis for Philip is an odd choice. But we'll see. We'll see how well he does for the name to catch on again. So let's get into his childhood. Yep. So chroniclers generally agree that Louis was a very friendly and cheerful youth. He had a handsome face, he had a fine body, and he had eloquent speech. Mm-hmm. And as we said, he had a big appetite, which sort of catches up with him a bit later. But right now he's, you know, he's doing a lot of hunting and fighting, and, you know, he's very...
Princeling.
Yes. So he's later known as Louis the Fat, but he's also called Louis the Battler.
Oh, that's a good one.
He's got many years of battling ahead of him, so get ready for that. Suja gives us the impression that he came off as rather simple-minded and sort of vapid. But his actions revealed sort of like an intelligence behind that facade. He was quite cunning, actually, and he was very, like, opportunistic. Cool. Like, he knew how to... Yeah, he knew how to handle people, did he? So he has street smarts, but he doesn't have book smarts. According to his father's advisor, Ivo of Chartres, said he was illiterate, preferring gambling and women to literature. but we love that.
Yes.
Good, like, well, obviously we're fans of literacy, but we're also fans of having fun.
Bit of both would be better, though.
Yes. But Louis did, just because he was illiterate, doesn't mean he didn't have a way with words. And we'll see him use his powers of persuasion and intimidation quite a bit throughout his reign.
Yeah. And I doubt he was actually illiterate. He probably was just too lazy. Like, you know, can't be bothered.
Yeah, well, maybe, I don't know. Yeah, maybe somebody tried to teach him to read and they sort of gave up. It wasn't, it's not an essential skill, learning to read.
Oh, okay.
At this time. Unless you're a cleric. Basically, there's no reason for you to read. Yeah. In fact, we see more evidence of literacy among queens than kings in this period. So that paints a bit of a picture of young Prince Louis. There's little else to say about his boyhood, except that it was probably a bit of a bummer when he was about 11 years old and his father imprisoned and divorced his mother on the grounds that she wasn't hot anymore. And he ran off with the married Countess of Anjou, Bertrada de Montfort. Very scandalous. Got him excommunicated.
Yeah.
So Prince Louis's relationship with his stepmother, Bertrada, probably quite tense. There was a suspicion that Ada may have tried to poison him as a child when he got ill once. But there's very little evidence. The tension never really boiled over to open conflict, and once Louis did take the throne, Ada was able to retire peacefully.
Yeah.
And her two sons, Philip Jr. and Fleury, were given castles to govern.
Yeah.
But they didn't get much land. So when one of them eventually did rebel, Philip, but he was quickly squashed because he didn't have that much power to begin with.
Yeah. Smart, though, not to give him too much.
Very smart. Louis had two sisters, full sister and half sister, who were both married to crusaders. So they both went off to the Holy Land. Yeah. So Louis's military career begins with his, quote, valiant efforts defending the territory his father had given him. And by the way, whenever I quote something in this episode, it's usually Suja, unless I specify something else.
Bear
that in mind. So, the territory his father had given him was the Vexin. What do you remember about the Vexin?
It's like the, middle, like a no man's land. Well, not no man's land, but, you know, the border, barrier.
It's definitely not a no man's land, because there is a lot in it. There are a lot of castles and stuff.
But, I mean, like, in terms of you're picturing it, like, two sides, it's in the middle.
It is the borderland between, Paris, the Île-de-France, and Normandy, which are very close together. It's the valley of the River Ept, which is actually where Charles the Simple made the treaty with Rollo, because it was sort of their border territory. So Louis, his first military exploits are defending the Vexin from its neighbor, King William Rufus of England, the son of William the Conqueror. So as a youth, he was, quote, bored with hunting and the boyish games which others of his age used to enjoy themselves and forget the pursuit of arms. So he's very serious and duty bound.
Yeah.
He does a bit of womening and gambling on the side, but mostly he's very serious. When Rufus went to war against King Philip, quote, Prince Louis's stout heart exulted at the chance to prove himself. His courage smiled at the test. He banished inertia, opened the gates to prudence, put an end to leisure, increased his concern. So Louis inherited a very poor kingdom, a kingdom that had been through a lot, especially with all the excommunication that had happened, while England was extremely rich at this time.
Yeah.
Inherited a very centralized state from the Anglo-Saxons.
Fertile lands.
Yeah, the Anglo-Saxons, for all their faults, were very good at running England, and that continued into the Norman times.
Good on them.
And, of course, we've got Normandy as well, so they're straddling the English Channel, which is a very important trade route.
Yeah.
So England's rich. France is landlocked and kind of poor. Or at least the royal domain is. We see the start of Louis's strong ability to especially bring together, to muster forces really quickly. That's a really important skill to have.
Yeah, because that's a very important skill.
There's no such thing as a standing army at this time. So you've got to very quickly get it together when...
Get it together.
Like, assemble the knights.
That just makes you think of Lord of the Rings when they're doing, in the third movie, and they're doing the battle, and then when the elephants come and the king around, he's like, regroup, reform the line.
Yeah. It's like that, only on a bigger long-term scale of, whenever a war starts, basically, it takes a few weeks for everyone to get their act together because they don't have an army ready in the field. Yeah. In France, it won't be a thing till 1500s, I think. They won't have a standing army.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So Suger hates William Rufus. And when William Rufus gets struck down by a stray arrow in the New Forest of England in 1100, Suger describes it as a divine revenge.
God, he really hates him.
But Louis would later have to deal with Rufus's brother, Henry I of England, who Suger does think more highly of, but he will become his true arch-nemesis, Henry I. So in 1099, Louis had become junior king, though he wasn't actually anointed or crowned. He was kind of like unofficial junior king. And I'm wondering if that was...
assumed almost.
Assumed, yeah. I'm wondering if it was because his parents were divorced. I'm not sure. But Philip I's disdain for his ex-wife Bertha did not extend to their son. Louis was always treated as the heir, and his father started needing him more and more as he was unable to lead his troops because he was too fat and too ill as well. Louis was turning out to be a vigorous, intelligent leader, while his younger half-brothers were still children. It was out of necessity that Louis became basically de facto king, and it's actually quite a shame that we don't count junior kingships in V on Throne, because that's when a lot of Louis's good stuff happened.
Too bad.
But we'll be counting it for all the other rounds, I guess. So Louis is in his 20s at this point, and the first few chapters of Suger kind of play out as a series of episodes in which Louis kind of intervenes in various conflicts throughout the land, mostly caused by unruly vassals, who will get...
Of course.
Much further into.
It's always those unruly vassals.
Yes. In particular, Louis is dealing with the Castellans, or the robber barons, who are the... Yeah, a Castellan is a guy who rules a castle, basically what that means.
Yeah.
And they vary from, just lords to counts, but they're minor lords in the royal domain.
Yeah.
So we're just dealing with locally the area around Paris.
Yeah.
Down to sort of Bourges, which is on the border of Aquitaine.
Yeah.
So Louis is going around punishing these lords when they get out of line, basically. And they learn to fear him pretty quickly. The very first guy he punishes is called Lord Bouchard of Montmorency, who had harassed Suger's Abbey of Saint-Denis. Ooh. So these men, they're very rapacious. They're not really into rules or, being nice to people. And John Julius Norwich describes these nobles as no better than brigands. So they're like... They're dressed as knights, but they behave like bandits. Sometimes the Castellans would be supported by larger nobles, like the House of Blois, which is still a nuisance. as in the case of Hugh of Le Puisay, who rebelled, got expelled from France, and died on pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And speaking of Jerusalem, we've got a lot of these minor lords bringing back plunder from the Crusades. which have just happened. The first Crusades just happened.
Do they have to give some to the king?
Well, that's the thing, is they hoard it for themselves and they get a lot of power from that. So that's why they're becoming such dragons. A threat that Louis now has to deal with them. Yeah. So Louis deals with this by basically finding any excuse to take their castles, to confiscate their land holdings.
I'll be like, oh, you sneezed. I'll take that. Yeah.
Mostly it's him acting on behalf of the church and being like, they're harassing this church land. Therefore, they lose everything.
And I'll take that.
The worst of these Castellans was Thomas of Marl. He was, quote, the vilest of men, a plague both to God and to men. His insupportable madness, like that of a cruel wolf, was increased by his confidence in possessing an impregnable castle. And this castle was the castle of Montaigu, which he had gained through marriage to a particularly wealthy heiress. And a few of the neighboring lords who hated him were trying to besiege him, including his own father, Enguerrand. His father was insinuating that Thomas wasn't his true son.
Someone's hated a bit of fun, even their own father.
Yeah. And apparently they'd gone on crusade together, so obviously that wasn't a good bonding experience.
Yeah, that was opposite. It's like, you know, when you test a true friendship by going traveling.
Yeah, it's that. So, these other local lords were besieging the castle, and then Prince Louis arrived and sort of asked them to back off. Yeah. And then when they did, Louis took the castle himself.
He's like, mine now!
And the other lords were a bit mad at first, but they were also quite intimidated by Louis. So they ended up teaming up after all. And then, quote, not long afterwards, Thomas lost both the castle and his marriage by annulment on the grounds of consanguinity. Mm. So yeah, Thomas was given a second chance, but this leopard was not going to change his spots. He did not use it wisely. He ended up getting wounded and captured by the king's men while fleeing battle. This is much later. Oh. And he died of his wounds while awaiting judgment in prison. Okay. So that was Thomas of Marl. But anyway, that's just one example of one of these minor lords. Another minor lord is a guy called Guy. I keep saying a guy called Guy. Guy the Red, Count of Rochefort. And King Philip made him his seneschal, so basically the manager of the royal household.
Yeah.
And according to Suger in 1104, quote, Louis agreed to wed Guy's daughter, not yet of marriageable age. But his affianced did not become his wife. For before the consummation of the marriage, the union was broken some years later on the ground of consanguinity. Mm. So we're hearing consanguinity a lot.
Yeah, we are.
Which, do you remember
it's
what
like consanguinity? It's like
the go-to. Do you remember what it is?
Is that the distantly related one?
Yeah, it's when, well, it's any kind of relation is consanguinity. Yeah. But it's basically the go-to excuse when you want an annulment, but it's never actually the real reason.
Yeah.
As we will see next episode with a certain woman who gets divorced from the King of France. I wonder who that will be. So this was due to the plotting. This divorce, the real reason in this case, was due to the plotting of the Rochefort's mortal enemies, the Garland family. As well as a timely visit by the Pope himself, who could ratify the annulment. We'll get back to the Pope visit. There's quite a few Pope visits in this episode. But,
of course.
Stephen de Garland, the leader of the Garland family, was a prominent chancellor. And he convinced King Philip and Prince Louis that Lucienne de Rochefort, the bride in question, was too low-born to be queen. Which was rich coming from Stephen, given he technically ranked lower than the Rochefort's. But this annulment is confirmed by Pope Pascal II at the Fifth Council of Troyes in 1107. Okay. And this is the same pope who lifted King Philip's excommunication last episode.
That would sound familiar.
Yeah. And he pretty much fled to France because of the investiture crisis with the emperor, Emperor Henry IV, which had led to him excommunicating Henry IV. So he needed allies in France, hence why he decided to turn a blind eye to all of King Philip's scandal that got him excommunicated. Meanwhile, Emperor Henry V, the future husband of Matilda of England, by the way, deposed his father, Henry IV. And Pascal was able to return to Rome to crown him emperor. Although his successor, Pope Gelasius II, would also end up having to flee to France because of Emperor Henry V, more or less repeating the same patterns as his father. So this period is kind of a cycle of, like, emperor appointing bishop, pope saying, no, you can't do that, emperor saying, yes, I can, pope saying, nah-uh, emperor saying, yeah-uh, pope excommunicating emperor, emperor chasing pope out of the country, and then the conflict more or less continues until one of them dies. At which point the whole cycle starts again. That's a big oversimplification of the investiture crisis, but that's my take on it. We're not getting into any further detail. Yeah. So, back to Prince Louis's annulment. His wife, Lucienne de Rochefort, she did well out of it. She ended up marrying a different lord, having about 8 kids in a lovely castle, not having the pressure to be queen.
Fertile Myrtle.
But her father, Guy, the Count of Rochefort, was not happy. And he decided to give Prince Louis yet another reason to make war on the robber barons like him. So, as soon as the Pope left, Guy the Red rebelled. Of course, Louis the VI is able to defeat Guy and his allies. There is a very long description of a siege and battle that we do not have time for, but just know it's a good description. Yeah. By this time, Louis was not even king yet, still, but he was very widely loved and feared, according to Suger. according to his best friend. And a number of times, a castle only had to hear that he was coming, and it would surrender.
And they're like, oh, okay, we surrender. Goodbye. Yeah.
So now we come to Louis VI's actual ascension from junior king to the king upon the death of his father, Philip I, on the 29th of July, 1108. Louis, by this point, was already nearly 30, and he'd been ruling France alongside his father for about a decade.
Is he married yet?
No, he married slightly later. About 10 years later, actually. But he's getting... 40s. Let's just say he's doing a lot of business on the side that's keeping him occupied.
You mean like business?
Yeah. But every kind of business. He's a busy man.
okay.
He apparently has scores of illegitimate children who are not recorded.
Damn.
So Louis is able... He hits the ground running during his reign because basically just continues ruling because he's already been ruling.
Yeah.
So he immediately set about cleaning up the kingdom, assembling his magnates and bishops at a council at Orléans, where he's also going to be crowned. So he's thinking, he's sort of multitasking. He's like, kill two birds with one stone while everyone's assembling for my coronation. Let's also do a council. Let's get it all out of the way.
He's smart.
He's very smart. So Louis VI is anointed at Orléans by Dame Bert, the Archbishop of Sens. Do you see something wrong with that?
It's not where it's meant to be. It's not the right bishop.
We'll be right back after this.
The commander said, don't worry, I don't have the authority to kill you today. Which was positive for that day anyway.
In 1993, Chris Moon was captured by the Khmer Rouge while clearing landmines in Cambodia. With survival probability low, Chris was brought in front of the boss.
He was just given a local nickname, Mr. Clever.
Hi, I'm Steve Windus, host of the Batting the Breeze podcast. I'd love you to check out how Chris survived, along with some other great human stories at battingthebreeze.com. Hopefully see you there.
Yes, both. It's not where it's meant to be. It's not the right bishop. Who is the right bishop and the right place?
Rams.
Yeah, Rams. So the Bishop of Rams, or the Archbishop of Rams, was very, very mad that Sans got to crown the king.
Yeah.
The tradition like, of...
That's
the
my job.
Yes. The tradition was very well established at this point. But the reason that Louis didn't like Reims was that the bishop had been appointed against the wishes of him and his father, likely during the excommunication. Yeah, it's part of this whole investiture thing of, like, the king didn't appoint you, so we're not going to recognize you. However, Louis was not very likely to get into too much trouble with the religious authorities. So we're not yet at the point where Suger is advising him. although he and Suja already know each other and are friends at this point. Yeah. But Louis is mainly leaning on our eminent theologian, Saint Ivo, Bishop of Chartres. He's a very old man, about 70 at this point.
Yeah.
Philip had persecuted him for siding with Queen Bertha,
Louis's
mom. However, Ivo had made up for it by negotiating with Pope Pascal to lift the excommunication. So he's the whole reason that happened. And of course, it probably doesn't hurt that he stuck up for Louis's mom now that Louis
is dead.
So Ivo's got the religious base covered. And meanwhile, in terms of administration, we've got Stephen de Garland, who dominated Louis's early reign. He was the Archdeacon of Notre Dame de Paris, but he's mainly in charge of the actual secular administration.
Yeah.
And Louis VI appointed him as his chancellor. But the church and Louis's future queen ended up getting him kicked out. So just to summarize what happens to Garland, because we don't have too much time to get into it, but the queen and the church plotted to get him sacked in the late 1120s. He was back in power in 1132, but he had a lot of his privileges revoked.
So it's like diminished power.
Yes. Garland was then involved in the assassination of a couple of prominent churchmen. Louis did his best to sort of shield him from excommunication.
Yeah.
But Garland at this point was effectively disgraced and his family lost their prominence.
Yeah.
Bit of a rise and fall there.
Faded into obscurity.
Yes. So back to the war stuff. Let's turn to France's most major external threat, which is also kind of an internal threat. But can you guess what that is?
England?
Yes, because England, as well as being a major power, also has land that's technically in France. By the way, Henry I of England, probably named after Henry I of France, because their dads were friends.
Yeah.
Henry I was friends with William the Conqueror before they ended up hating each other.
Yeah.
Because there are no other Henrys in the Norman family, so I'm assuming that's where it comes from. So in 1106, shortly before his reign, Louis had helped Henry I of England take Normandy from his rebellious nephew, William Clito. William Clito is the son of Robert Curthose, who was William the Conqueror's eldest son. So William Clito is the actual eldest son of the eldest son. So he should be King of England.
Why was he not?
Because he wasn't in England when William Rufus fell off his horse and died. Shot and died. Henry the First was the younger brother of Rufus, but he acted very quickly. He got to Westminster Abbey first. He got crowned.
Swooped in.
Clito had Normandy because he inherited that from his father, because Robert Curthose was the Duke of Normandy. But Louis decided, let's pincer Normandy, England and France pincer Normandy, and they conquered it together. But when Henry of England got to conquering the Vexin, a, quote, southern hatred flared up between the two kings, and they fought bitterly over the castle of Gisors. When each side had collected a huge army, it came to the place commonly called Les Planches de Neufles by the ill-omened castle, where the ancient tradition of the inhabitants holds that negotiations there never or hardly ever succeeded.
So
guess what happens? Yes.
It negotiations, doesn't happen.
Negotiations quickly break down. Louis manages to get the Normans to retreat, though, once he threatens them with open battle. In 1113, there is a brief peace where Louis recognizes Brittany and Maine as vassals of Henry of England. So England kind of has the whole northwest of France, which is stuff that Louis never really controlled anyway. But 3 years later, by 1116, they're back at it, and Louis is now supporting William Clito trying to take Normandy. So he's fully flipped. Suja then tries to act like Louis wins the ensuing war against Normandy, but he definitely tells a fib here and is contradicted by the Norman sources, of course. The Normans recount that there was a severe defeat for Louis against Henry at the Battle of Bremul in 1119, which is a battle that Suja conveniently ignores. So you know it must have been bad if he just completely doesn't mention it.
Yeah, yeah. So let's skip over that.
Curiously, we do get a fun legend from Louis VI, despite him winning, losing this battle. So apparently a Norman soldier comes up to seize the reins of the king's horse, trying to capture him, crying, "The king is taken!" And then Louis responds by whacking this guy with his mace and saying, "The king is not taken, neither at war nor at chess." We love a whacking. We love
it's
a
such
a,
like,
a
cartoon. I'm imagining such a cartoon, like, and you know, moment there.
We love slapstick with blunt instruments on this podcast. As with, remember, Constance of Arles fully whacking a guy in the head with her scepter?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun. Taking out his eye. She took out his eye.
Oh, right. I forgot about that part. But,
yeah, we said something about, we've made like a golf joke or something. out of the park. Anyway, so that's not golf. That's baseball. Whatever. So after Bremul, this defeat, Louis retreated to Reims, where he employed a better weapon than the mace.
Ooh.
A big church council.
Oh.
So the Council of Reims appealed to Pope Calixtus II, the new pope, basically saying, Henry's winning the war. No fair.
Do something.
Let's get him in trouble for something.
Excommunicate him, please.
Calixtus didn't take action against Henry, but he did step in to reconcile the two kings and brought the war to an end the following year in 1120.
Oh, no fun.
No fun, but France did just suffer a horrible defeat and didn't and kind of got out scot-free for it. So that's pretty good.
That is pretty good.
Part of this peace was Henry of England's heir, William Adelin, so his son, pledging loyalty to the King of France.
Oh.
For Normandy.
Oh.
So Louis is like, I'll recognize you as the heir to Normandy in England if you say, you know, Normandy's still a vassal of France, but the King of England is the Duke of Normandy. It's very complicated. And this was a thing that all English kings and their heirs actually did right up to the Hundred Years' War, would be they'd pledge homage to the French king for their lands in France, but England is England. England is a separate entity.
England is England.
But the same individual just happens to own both things.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
So after pledging loyalty, William Adelin returned to England a few weeks or months later on a boat called the White Ship.
Oh.
Yeah. So his crewmen were actually probably celebrating the victory over France.
Having too much fun.
Getting rather giddy, and crashed the boat. And William Adelin, of course, died in perhaps the most consequential shipwreck of all time. More important than the Titanic, because, like, the Titanic didn't have the heir to the English throne on board.
True.
So, this eventually, as we know from our Noble Houses Patreon episode, or as the casual listener may know from just generally history, William Adelin's death made his sister Matilda, at this point the Holy Roman Empress, the heir to England. And she, of course, ends up getting widowed, marrying Geoffrey Plantagenet of Anjou, and becomes the mother of the Plantagenets. But of course, before that, we have a big civil war that's going to pop off in England between her and her cousin, Stephen of Blois.
Yes.
But we're still about 10 years off from that, so we'll come back to that. That sort of starts at the very end of Louis's reign, so we won't talk much about it.
Mm.
So rewinding a little to Pope Calixtus II, this pope who showed up to the Council of Reims. He had become pope the same year as the Battle of Bremul in 1119, when his predecessor, Gelasius II, died of gout. And Calixtus is himself a Frenchman. Hmm. He was the Bishop of Vienne and a member of the Burgundian House of Ivrea, who we've encountered before. And he also just happens to be the uncle of a certain lovely maiden named Adelaide of Maurienne.
Hmm.
And can you guess what happens to this lovely maiden?
Guessing that's the queen?
Yeah, she becomes the queen. So after his divorce, it was, as we said, Louis waited quite a while before getting married, just because there were no good options available.
Everyone was married or too young.
But yeah, he marries Adelaide of Maurienne, and they had a lot
How old she?
Of children. Well, he's about 35. She'd be teens, I assume. So there's about a 20-year age gap. But they have a lot of babies.
A lot. Good, little, little.
And we'll get into that in Lovey on Throne. Modern historian Elizabeth Hallam writes that Adelaide was, quote, a powerful, effective, and competent queen who played a formal partnership role in government.
What is it about the name Adelaide and, like, being competent?
Yeah, because Hugh Capet's wife was Adelaide, and she was a good queen who he got along with.
I know.
Adelaides are just good eggs, I guess.
I guess they are.
And a lovely city in Australia. So,
yeah.
Adelaide, her father was the Count of Savoy, Humbert II. In the background of our story, she'd been married to Louis VI in 1115.
Okay.
And the alliance not only secured France's southeastern border, but of course, now that Calixtus, her uncle, is Pope, is basically a marriage alliance to the Pope himself.
Yeah.
So back to the Council of Reims, this council where Calixtus ended the war with England. He also started another war at the same time. Can you guess who with?
Crusades?
No, not a crusade.
Oh.
We're not quite up to the Second Crusade yet. But,
the Emperor.
The Emperor, yes. So Calixtus sort of was waxing poetic about the virtues of Louis VI, while in the same breath condemning the Holy Roman Emperor Henry V to excommunication. Of course. His main weapon.
Yeah.
So Suja says, then enriched by the monies vowed to him by the churches, Pope Calixtus made his glorious way to Rome, where he was received in pomp by clergy and people, and happily administered the church with greater competence than many of his predecessors has shown. So, bit of shade to Pascal and Galasius there from Suja.
Yeah. Just all the previous ones, mainly.
It's like, those popes were rubbish, but this guy...
He good.
And Suja had personally served Galasius, so probably a first-hand witness to his incompetence. So Calixtus was joined in Italy by none other than Suja, who was an emissary for King Louis. So they went to Italy together, and Calixtus got safely returned to Rome.
Yay.
And Suja ended up having to come back because the abbot of Saint-Denis before him, a guy called Adam, died. And this is when Suja has his entire chapter about how he's not worthy to be the abbot. But he comes back to France anyway, and he's the abbot. And this is where Suja gets to the height of his power.
Yeah.
This is when Suja's the full-on advisor now. Top dog. So when Suja returned, he found France on the brink of war with the Empire. And the Empire, by the way, is now allied with England because Henry V, Emperor, is married to Matilda, Henry of England's daughter. Yeah. So, the two Henrys have teamed up. And in 1124, there are whispers going around that Emperor Henry V is planning to invade France. I just took a long sip of water to just leave you in suspense. So, on the advice of Henry of England, Emperor Henry decided to do a sneak attack on Reims, which is quite close to the imperial border. Yeah. But somehow, this super secret plan got to the one person who it needed to be kept a secret from, who was Louis. So Louis sees this little sneak attack force of the Emperor coming towards France.
Yeah.
And in response, he summons the largest army that France has seen since the days of Charlemagne.
Oh, yes. So it's like this tiny little army coming to France, and then they just, there's this huge ass of one just waiting there, be like, when are they coming?
Basically. This is, I think, one of Louis's greatest achievements. And we talked about how important mustering troops is.
Yes.
This is the ultimate muster of troops.
Yes, the ultimate quick muster.
Obviously, a lot of this is Suja making a huge deal out of it, but especially because Louis does a huge symbolic gesture. He needs some holy guidance as he gathers together his troops to inspire them for battle. Suja is very keen to lend the aid of the Abbey of Saint-Denis in any way he can.
Yeah.
He sends a regiment of troops drawn from Saint-Denis' land who become Louis' personal guard of troops. Ooh. And with them, the king took from the altar the banner belonging to the county of the Vexin, which he had held in Saint-Denis. And in accordance with his vow, received it as if from his lord, as in God. At the head of a handful of men to protect him, he flew off against the enemy, calling on the whole of France to follow him in strength. The unusual audacity of the enemy evoked indignation and inspired in the French their usual bravery. Moving everywhere, it called forth nightly levies, and produced men and forces mindful of their past courage in their past victories. Damn. So this banner that Louis gets...
That's a good banner.
It's called the Oriflamme, or the Golden Flame. And it was like a long, streaming red banner with a flaming sun on it.
Cool.
And it's obviously... It's originally represented the Vexin, which was Louis's sort of practice territory as junior king, and was sort of in storage at the Basilica of Saint-Denis. So he's just going through his storage, being like, what can help the king? So he gave this standard to Louis.
I hope he blessed it.
He told him it belonged to Charlemagne, which is always a good tactic. Louis, like, yoink, took the Oriflamme, waved it about, and gave a great speech. We don't really know the exact wording of the speech.
We just know it's a great speech.
Yes, but we do know that the speech is the origin of a battle cry, Montjoie Saint-Denis, which means something like Saint-Denis.
Ooh.
Protect our country, something like that, in old French. And yeah, he's rallied the forces against the German emperor. The same standard, the Oriflamme, would be used from this point, 1124, all the way up to the Battle of Agincourt in 1415, when it was lost to Henry V of England.
Yeah.
Kind of spooky that it was first raised to combat Emperor Henry V, and then it was lost to Henry V of England.
You mean Henry
V? No, they're both called Henry
V. Oh, right. Henry V. Sorry, I was thinking England.
But of different countries.
There.
Yeah, I just thought it was kind of spooky.
True, Fifth. Oh, yeah, that is.
Two Henry V's is bookended by.
Yeah.
Interesting. So that's the Oriflamme, which will probably get him points in Enchanté, I imagine. As will battle cry, Montjoie Saint-Denis.
Yes, that will.
So the Capetian lords show up. Louis' first cousin, Count Ralph of Vermandois. And his second cousin, Duke Hugh II of Burgundy. So we see the Capetians once again sticking together, which is quite good to see.
Yeah.
Also in attendance is the elderly William IX of Aquitaine, who had been loyal to King Philip. If you remember, he'd barged in on an excommunication council and been like, don't excommunicate my king.
Yeah. He's like, don't you dare.
He's still kicking around. He shows up with troops.
Damn.
One of the other magnates who showed up for this huge muster was Tybalt, the head of the House of Blois. And it's actually kind of a miracle that he showed up, because he was pretty much a thorn in the side for Louis's entire reign. He sided with England a number of times. He's the brother of Stephen, who, of course, will be King of England. And this Tybalt, he's either called Tybalt II of Champagne or Tybalt IV of Blois. He rules both. Mm-hmm. He brings the Blois lands back together after they've been divided between the sons.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, various deaths. Stephen's off in Normandy. His other brother, William, was mentally disabled. So Tybalt basically gets all the land. He becomes known as Tybalt the Great. Because he's presumably the greatest of the Tybalts. Tybalt has also, as we said, done a lot of meddling in the royal domain, supporting the Castellans with their rebellions against the king.
Yeah.
But in this case, quite impressively, Louis is
loyal.
For once able to get Tybalt the Great on side.
I guess maybe just really hated the emperor.
It's a thing of like, we don't want Rams to get burned down. A greater enemy, I suppose.
Yeah.
So what happens with this war with the emperor? So Louis got this giant army, and Suger, of course, is right there to tell us what happens next. The emperor heard the news of the preparations for this great and terrifying expedition, and of the service of so great an army of strong men. Using feint and dissimulation to hide the real reason for it, the emperor fled secretly and slunk off in the other direction, preferring to put up with the ignominy of retreat rather than expose his empire and his person, already in danger of ruin, to the harshest reprisals of the French.
So he just ran.
So Louis just managed to win a war.
Like, brought a blow. Yeah, damn.
Yeah.
That's a good win.
And even better news, after Henry V slinks off, he dies just weeks after returning him to Germany. Because he has cancer as well.
He didn't die because of shame.
Shame and cancer. You know, both equally harmful things. So if we're to believe Suger, this was far from the best part of Louis's reign, though.
Ooh.
So this is slightly questionable to me. But Suger says that his, quote, finest exploit and, quote, most noble deed was his avenging of the murder of Blessed Charles the Good of Denmark.
Oh.
Who we mentioned in our Noble Houses episode, but you will have definitely forgotten.
Yeah. What did he... Now did he...
So, he was the first Count of Flanders to not belong to the House of Flanders.
Oh.
Which is why we ended up mentioning him. Because we did a whole segment on the House of Flanders in our Patreon episode. He was their cousin. His mother was Flemish. So he had a claim through her. And the House of Flanders was kind of in a shambles. If you remember last episode, in Philip's episode, they'd had all these civil wars and everything.
Yeah.
So they weren't in a good state. And also half of them had ended up running off on crusade. Charles of Denmark ended up with Flanders, but the Flemish nobility were not happy with him. Even though he had this great reputation of... Well, Suger thought Charles was the bee's knees because he was very charitable and generous to the church.
Ah, that explains.
Though Suger neglects to mention that he also expelled all the Jews from Flanders.
Oh.
Which is the earliest mass expulsion of Jews, of Jewish people, I think we've encountered on the podcast. We've seen tightening restrictions on them and everything.
Yeah, but not...
But this is the first time that a region is fully expel them.
God.
So, in 1127, karma catches up with Charles, who is assassinated and dismembered by his political enemies while praying at the altar of a church in Bruges. Which leads to a huge massacre throughout the city, as everyone's just at each other's throats. Yeah. So, because there's no clear candidate for who should now be Count of Flanders, and because Matilda of Flanders, King Henry of England's mother, was actually, a claimant, Louis decided to intervene and decided that it should be the king who decides who the next Count of Flanders should be.
Hmm.
Because, I'm the king. Flanders is in France.
I can do what I want.
I can do what I want. So Louis actually does a great job subjugating Flanders. He loses no time getting there ahead of the game.
Yay.
He rather craftily announces that the new Count of Flanders is William Clito.
Oh!
The chief rival to the throne of England. He's still kicking around.
Oh! Smart little cookie.
Not for very long, though, because he dies the next year. In 1128.
But he had children.
Nope, no children. He's over. Shiz indeed is probably what Louis was saying. Yeah. So that's a bit inconvenient. He dies from wounds sustained in a battle against another claimant to Flanders, the more random option of Thierry of Alsace.
Who?
So we've got Alsatians turning up.
They're like, we just want to join in.
So it's a weird situation where Louis kind of won the war, but his claimant died. So now he has to kind of say, I guess Thierry's the count now because he's not England.
As long as it's not England, it's fine.
Yeah. So it's kind of a weird situation where he kind of loses the war, but Thierry's now his vassal. So it's he kind of wins the war. It wasn't his choice of who to be count, but...
Yeah, but... It's not England.
Yeah. So Thierry swears fealty to Louis VI in exchange for the king's withdrawal back to Paris.
Oh.
Meanwhile, there's some people to punish for assassinating Charles of Denmark.
Yes.
So the leader of the Flemish nobles, a guy called Burchard, quote, suffered exquisite torture in death. Tied to the upper part of a high wheel, exposed naked to the rapacity of crows and other birds of prey, his eyes torn out and his whole face lacerated, pierced by a thousand blows from arrows, lances, and spears, he perished miserably, and his body was thrown into a sewer. This is the dark side of Suger, by the way. He loves getting into the gruesome details.
Which I love. But all I'm imagining is, you know how at the circus they have the spinning wheel and someone's on it and they throw the... I'm imagining that, but also with, crows and stuff, and instead of daggers, it's spears.
Yeah. Another conspirator named Berthold, so we've got Burchard and Berthold.
It's always B.
Yeah. Was, quote, hanged from a gibbet. A gibbet is a sort of cage thing.
Oh!
It's a cage that forces you to stand up.
Oh.
So he was hanged from a gibbet with a dog. And as the dog was struck, so people whipping the dog, it took its anger out on Berthold. So it chewed his whole face and, horrible to relate, covered him with excrement. So more miserable than the most miserable of men, he ended his wretched life in perpetual death.
That poor dog, though.
Poor dog, poor man. Dog is just clawing and shitting itself all over this man.
No, but it didn't do anything.
Yeah, I know.
Didn't serve to be punished. Maybe it bit the king.
But Suger says this is Louis's greatest achievement. It's punishing these people who killed Blessed Charles.
And the poor innocent dog.
So Suger concludes by saying, quote, Flanders was washed clean and almost rebaptized by these various forms of revenge and the great outpouring of blood.
Love how they go, revenge.
I will always say revenge.
Love when you do it like that. It makes me think of one of my Japanese friends. She knows how to make me laugh by going, she'll purposely do this because she knows I find it funny. She'll say arigato with like an American accent. Just to, like, obviously,
arigato.
She says it. Yeah, yeah, she'll be like that. And it makes me laugh every time.
Love it. So yeah, we've now met the darkest side of Suger. There's actually more gruesome details that we're going to come to in the
round. I feel as though he's someone who'd love true crime.
Oh, Suger's all over it. Suger would love it.
Yeah. He'd be like documentary true crime podcast.
Like he's a really unassuming, quiet person. And he's like listening in his headphones. But you don't know that he's listening to like a story of a massacre. So, after this, the records of Louis VI's prowess in war begin to dwindle as he approaches the age of 50.
You mean getting fat?
Yes. Yes, that is what I mean. So, while he continued to go on progresses and command armies, he could no longer ride a horse due to his obesity.
Wonder how obese you have to be to not ride a horse.
Ride a horse. Pretty obese, yeah, like Henry VIII levels.
Damn.
So he had to give his battle orders from a cart or a wagon, presumably.
Yeah, it's not very kingly.
But he's still going around. He's still going to all these... He's not just staying in his castle. He's still going everywhere.
He's like, nope, I don't care that it's, like, inconvenient for me to move around. I'm doing it.
Yeah. Like, but Your Majesty, you can't walk. Then carry me!
Yeah, it's like, I don't care. Drag me if you must.
Yeah. So Louis is still a busy man. He has yet another exiled pope showing up at his doorstep.
They just love going to France anytime there's exile. They're like, literally, it's their go-to, like, vacation home.
Oh, I'm getting exiled from my home and everything I love is getting destroyed, but at least I'm going to have some baguettes when I get to France.
Yes.
Or, you know, some croissants. Some wine. Some wine, some coffee. Be lovely.
Some cheese.
In 1130...
I don't think they had coffee then.
In 1130. No, they did not, sadly. Again, America. But, what did they have? They didn't have tea either. They had,
wine.
They had wine. They only had wine. Yeah. Explained a lot, really. In 1130, Louis harbored the exiled Pope Innocent II, who...
wasn't so innocent when he's exiled.
Who held a great council at Etampes. So, yeah. Louis basically backed him as the legitimate pope because, for once, he wasn't kicked out by the emperor. He was kicked out by the Romans, the people of Rome.
Oh God! That's saying something though. The Romans kick out him.
The empire is actually in a bit of a shambles because they're actually between emperors.
They don't have time for popes.
Yeah, well, Henry V didn't have a clear heir, so yeah, a bit of a shambles there. And Rome has actually elected an anti-pope named Anacletus II. Yes, there's two popes.
Good anti-pope.
Two popes. So the kings of both France and England took this chance to pay their respects to the true pope, Innocent, and show him how magnificent and generous to the pope they could be. So they're kind of in competition here.
Who could be nicer?
Yeah. So Suger writes that Louis definitely had the more fun and extravagant feast rather than Henry.
Also the upper hand.
Yeah.
The pope is with him.
Well, Henry spends most of his reign in Normandy, they're kind of right next to each other. Yeah, yeah.
So he's kind of like Richard.
Henry hosts him at Chartres, which is Tybalt the Great's land. So obviously their alliance is going well.
Yeah,
yeah. So after all these feasts, the Pope went to Germany to sort out this emperor business. And there he crowned Emperor Lothar III.
Lothar.
Yeah, he was the only emperor of the short-lived Supplinburg dynasty. So Innocent declared Lothar as king of the Romans, which basically means he's going to be the emperor when they get to Rome and crown him. But Innocent still couldn't go back to Rome because of the mob. It's so against him. So Lothar III goes to Rome and gets the anti-pope Anacletus to crown an emperor. So it's a bit of a mess where he's been crowned by both popes. So he's very ugly. He's
truly holy. The true pope.
Yeah. But this all gets resolved because Lothar III dies a few years later in 1137. Doesn't last very long. We'll let Pontifex eventually get to that huge mess that's happening in the East.
Okay.
But back to what went on during the Pope's brief visit to, or I guess lengthy visit to France. Abbot Suger recounts, quote, "Meanwhile, a singular and hitherto unknown struck the French kingdom. King Louis's son, Philip, a healthy and agreeable boy, was riding one day outside Paris."
Oh, no.
Oh, no. "When his horse collided with a devil of a pig in the road and fell down very heavily, throwing the noble boy, his rider, against a stone, which crushed him to pieces under its weight." So what I'm picturing here is he's been thrown against a stone, and the stone has kind of fallen.
Fell onto...
And crushed him.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
That pig.
"The citizens and all those who heard of it were grief-stricken. That very day he had summoned the army for an expedition, and they exclaimed, wept, and lamented."
Also, the person who owned that pig was probably like, oh, shit, he got out again, and now it's killed the king-to-be.
Yeah. So the soldiers picked up the delicate boy almost at death's door. So he's not dead. Took him to a nearby house where at nightfall, alas, he died.
Aww.
He was buried like a king at the Church of Saint-Denis.
Aww.
So Prince Philip, the promising heir, has died in 1131, 2 years after being crowned junior king. And yeah, not even a wild boar this time. It's just a farmer's pig trips him over. So Suger at this point talks about how he himself consoles the king by basically saying, and this is paraphrasing, "Look, you've got a second son. This is Louis Jr.
Not as great.
He's going to be the new king. So like there. Let's like sort him out now. And while the Pope's still here, we can get the Pope himself to anoint Louis Jr. as the future king. So that's all fine and dandy. So the second son, Louis Jr., had been intended for the church, actually. But now was being called to be king, and we will see this upbringing play a major role in how he behaves and rules next episode, when he becomes Louis VII.
I'm guessing he's not very fun.
Well, we'll see. But spoiler alert, no. He's not. He doesn't have a reputation for being fun. But I am still midway through my research, so maybe I'll discover some fun things. Who knows? Louis VI, meanwhile, is about to die. But it is anything but sudden, because thanks to Suger, we have two entire chapters dedicated to his slow, painful decline into oblivion. So I will cut out most of the stuff about him praying, which is about half of it. But the rest, I'll either quote or paraphrase. At this point, Louis VI, he's failing both mentally and physically, yet he continues to order his armies to march on England and Champagne right up to the end, ordering from his deathbed that the castles of Bonneval, Chateau Renard, and Saint-Prisson be burned to the ground. Suger writes that King Louis, quote, was worn out by his corpulence and by the continual strain of his tasks. For should anything offensive to royal majesty occur anywhere in his kingdom, he could not bear to let it go unpunished. Although he was 60, he was so knowledgeable and hardworking that had it not been for the perpetual obstacle of his swollen body, he would have overcome and destroyed all his enemies.
Damn, he sounds really dedicated.
He is very dedicated. Suger continues, on his return from this expedition at the new castle of Montreux, he had a very serious attack of diarrhea, as sometimes happened, and began to be very worried. day by day, his diarrhea troubled him more.
Ew.
It's a great line. And in order to stop it, the doctors gave him many unpleasant potions, forcing him to swallow various extremely bitter powders, which even healthy and vigorous men could not have borne. In these similar sufferings, he remained sweet-tempered and benevolent, spoke kindly to everyone, was available to all, and treated everyone as pleasantly as if he suffered no pain.
Okay, if you just, May, are you imagining him, like, on the toilet, like, permanently on the toilet, but people still coming to visit him, he's still, like, giving orders and still trying to be king, but he's just permanently on the toilet?
Yeah, in fact, he decides to give his last confession in front of an assembly of bishops and abbots.
And I bet he's on the toilet.
On the toilet, or his bed is just covered in...
Or there's a hole cut out in the mattress.
Yeah. Let's imagine that. So these, bishops just gathered around this...
And they're like, oh God, holding their nose.
Yeah. So, he makes his last confession. He dedicates some donations to the church in his final hour. And after this, Suger comes to the king's bed weeping, and the king tells him, "Do not weep, dear friend, on my behalf. You ought rather to rejoice greatly that God's mercy had permitted me to prepare myself to meet him, as you see." So he's like, good thing I'm getting a slow, painful death, because it's giving me time to get stuff out of the way.
Oh, to get stuff organized, like, you know, leave it prepared.
So, however, this deathbed actually turns out to be a false alarm. Because Louis seems to make a miraculous recovery.
Oh, damn.
To the point that he's off on another progress around the royal domain.
Oh, damn.
And during this progress, he starts to have some certain negotiations with Aquitaine. And here at the 11th hour of Louis VI's reign is where we meet a teenage girl named...
Eleanor.
Eleanor of Aquitaine. So it's 1137... And Eleanor's dad, Duke William X of Aquitaine, was going on a pilgrimage to the shrine of Santiago de Compostela in Spain.
Hmm.
A pilgrimage in which he would fall ill and die. So he's,
of course.
He's off to
be his death. Just avoid pilgrimages. Every time they go on, they die.
Yeah, or they die on the way back from Jerusalem or something like that. But before he left, William X entrusted his daughter and heiress, Eleanor, to the king as both a ward and... as a wife to the new crown prince, Louis VII. Suger is sent with Louis VII to Aquitaine, where he is to marry Eleanor, and she is to be crowned as junior queen in her ancestral home of Poitiers. And this is the last and possibly hugest political achievement of Louis's reign. Because, you know, obviously, William X dies soon after. And Eleanor inherits about... half of France. It's a lot of land is Aquitaine at this point. Because Aquitaine is not just what we would now call Aquitaine, but it's also Poitou, it's also Gascony, it's also Auvergne.
It's just everything.
So it's like, it's this big, like, upside down L that goes across the whole southwest and middle of France. And there'll be a map somewhere. So this is a big achievement. Because now the heir to the throne, Louis VII, is also the Duke of Aquitaine through marriage. So provided Louis VII can hold on to his wife, this will be great for France.
Yeah. If not, it won't be.
Nothing at all will go wrong ever.
We'll go wrong. It'll be a happy, lovely marriage.
It's not like that entire left of France region will belong to, say, England.
That's never going to happen. That's just a crazy thought.
It's a crazy thought.
I know.
So meanwhile, King Louis VI was back in Paris suffering from a severe attack, not just of diarrhea this time, but a full-on dysentery.
Ew.
Though, to be honest, it was probably a dysentery already.
Yeah.
Then, after another confession, he dies on the 1st of August, horse's birthday, 1137.
Yeah, my brother's birthday.
Is your brother a horse?
Oh, I'm happy you remember that it's a horse's birthday.
Yeah, because I was literally just editing last episode and you
brought it up. Yeah, but I told you. Yeah. I know, so I'm happy you remembered it.
I wouldn't have remembered it otherwise. So Louis, he's managed to outlive his rival, Henry I of England, by the way, by about a year and a half. So he lives long enough to see the English anarchy explode after Henry the First.
And he's like,
yeah. So right now things are looking really bad for England, really good for France at the end of Louis's reign.
He's like, good time to die.
Yeah. So let's hope Louis the Seventh doesn't screw anything up. I'm sure it'll be fine. I'm sure, you know.
I know.
The Angevin Empire won't exist, I'm sure. So, apparently Louis, who is sometimes nicknamed the King of Saint-Denis, wanted to be buried in front of the altar at Saint-Denis, but the spot was taken by none other than Carloman the First, Charlemagne's brother, who died of a nosebleed. And I did not expect Carloman to pop up in Suger's Chronicle, but there you go. However, after that, the gravediggers either found a good spot right next to Carloman, or they just didn't find a body in Carloman's grave. Which leads me to think, is there a Carloman zombie running around, bleeding from the nose everywhere?
Or someone just was like, oh, I don't see a body, even though there's one right in front of them. No, I don't see a skeleton, nothing. Nope.
Let's just tamp that down.
Yeah.
Just squish that a bit.
Squish now the space. Put some dirt over it. Just a thin layer so there was never anybody.
Yeah, so we don't really know how that ended
up. He got an empty spot.
Yeah.
Did he get buried there, though?
Yes, he gets buried in front of the altar. They find space. Okay. They find a bit of real estate, though. Mm-hmm. And that's the life of Louis the Sixth. Let's get into Enchanté.
Enchanté.
Okay, so first you've got the official portrait by Joseph Mary Blondel in the 19th century. Of Louis the Sixth.
Very Roman nose.
Is it? Oh yeah, I guess. Kind of.
Well, Romany French nose.
Yeah, I was thinking it's a very French nose. He obviously saw the name Louis the Fat and was like, we're running with that.
I do like his little locks though.
Yeah.
Little curls.
There's a few medieval depictions that I think this is based off. I'll just send them.
It's a different portrait.
Yeah, it is a bit different.
Little boots.
There's one here which is which is Louis looking a bit sad because he's apparently mourning the death of his son.
He looks pregnant.
But you can see all of these have Louis in the blue cape, the red robe,
crown, obviously.
Which this portrait is based on, the fleur-de-lis crown. Yeah. Classic.
What's
French
the
cape.
Two things that he's holding in the second one? He's got like a branch, scepter, then a
he's got like a some kind of
the mini one,
some kind of maybe it's the palm branch of victory or something like that, and a fleur-de-lis scepter.
I'm liking these depictions.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of depictions, actually.
It's nice to see a king in mourning.
Yeah, we see him with all sorts of hats on in these depictions. It's they're quite diverse.
Yeah, the second one is very classic, like passport photo.
I think all of these will be on the WordPress, as I say. But we're just going to speed through them. So I've got like a medieval depiction of him commanding the building of a church.
Oh yeah, he's like, come on.
In which he is the same height as the church, because it's medieval.
Yeah.
I've got a coronation depiction, where he's sort of decked out in the fleur-de-lis scepter. Although he himself looks a bit pathetic in this.
Wow, he has so many depictions. I'm loving that. It's nice to see.
Yeah. Well, he's got a few in the Grand Chronicle of France, which I think this next one is from.
Okay, everyone looks really angry, like, on the other side. They're like, meh.
Nobody really ever looks like they're having fun in medieval depictions. Also, from the same chronicle, I've got fighting the King of England.
You mean Louis fighting?
Sorry, Louis fighting Henry, the King of England.
Yeah. Henry fighting Henry, the King fighting himself.
Look, there's been a lot of confusing names.
Yeah.
Louis's looking pretty good there.
I like how you can distinctly tell each side.
You definitely know who the King of France is based on the one that's covered in fleur-de-lis and in blue.
Yeah, and also if you look, the hat, the helmet, it's different.
And going a bit later, back to the 19th century, we've got a painting that's on, it's a fresco, so it's a wall painting, on the, in the Ville, what is it? I forget, what is it called in France? The Hotel de Ville, that's it. So, like, the town hall in Paris has this depiction of Louis above a door, issuing a city charter.
Yeah. Okay, he's looking very Roman emperor in this.
Does he look Roman emperor? I mean, he's got a kingly crown.
Yeah, I know. Maybe like I can't really see the crown. I see like the clothes.
Oh yeah, the way he's sort of pointing.
Yeah, imposing. It's very like
he's like fight to the death, and everyone's like we're here for a charter meeting, and he's like oh sorry.
But he's also like leaning back on his throne, being like yes, do this.
Yes, do this. I'm too fat to get up. Those are the best depictions of that I found. There's quite a lot.
When's the last time we had a king with this many?
Long time.
Well, probably what, like Charlemagne?
Charlemagne, Louis the Pious had a few. Yeah, I just found a lot of little ones that a lot of them are quite the same. There's like a billion coronation ones. I just chose the one that looked the best. And then I've got one here. Not a depiction, but his epitaph survives. So the sort of grave, his sort of grave marking. It was in the Basilica of Saint Denis originally, but now it's in Cluny Museum in Burgundy.
You like just make out the words on the stone. I like that.
Yeah. So it says, let's try to read it. it's obviously Latin because it says Rex at the start.
Yeah, that's how I knew.
Everything else is quite hard to read.
Rex FRMLO RVPHILIRO something RE, I think GIS FH.
I think it's like King Louis, son of Philip, King of France. Something like that. So that's our depictions for Louis the Sixth. Of course, we've got a few epithets to go through. Yeah. So, obviously, he's called Louis the Fat, which is his most common one. Suger doesn't call him Louis the Fat, even though his chronicle is called The Life of Louis the Fat. He refers to him as the Glorious Louis.
Hmm.
He's also called Louis the Fighter, or Le Batailleur in French.
I like that.
Pretty, or the Battler as well. Fighter or the Battler. Good for a podcast called Battle Royale.
Yes, it is.
He's also known as Louis the Justicia. A justicia being someone who delivers justice.
Justice.
Refers to his treatment of the Castellans and the robber barons.
Mm.
And he is sometimes known as the King of Saint-Denis, which might be a backhanded compliment to say, like, you only ruled the stuff around Saint-Denis. but it more likely refers to him.
Really
doing everything he could to make Suger's Abbey of Saint-Denis the Abbey of France. So that is the depictions. Of course, we also have the first raising of the Oriflamme standard.
I like that.
Which, if you Google Oriflamme.
Oh, I'm looking at the banner now. Yeah, it's nice.
There's a few depictions of it. It's the streaming red one. It looks like a comet
with a
sun on it. It's pretty cool. It's a cool banner. So it's always there accompanying the royal standard.
I was thinking more firework, but you know.
Mm. And it's actually supposedly where the red in the French flag comes from.
Oh.
Red, white, and blue.
Yeah.
So, that's pretty cool. The Oriflamme. The battle cry, Montjoie Saint-Denis, which is cried throughout the...
Ages,
yeah. And that is Ancho Tate. What do we want to give him? Scoring.
I think I have to give him a high for this score.
Yeah, it's pretty good. A lot of good depictions.
Above 5.
Yeah.
Like, come on, he's got, like, the battle cry, that banner... Mm. He's got the loads of depictions.
We've officially reached the period where most kings will have a lot of depictions. Now we're in the 1100s, now that art is more of a thing that has survived at least. I mean, a lot of these depictions are actually from 200, 300 years later, but that shows his legacy has gone. Yeah. What do you want to give?
A 7 or 8.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to say 8, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to go for 8, yeah. I like it.
8's good. All right, that's an 8 for Enchanté. That's a 16 for Enchanté. 2 8s.
It's impressing me. Like, I didn't know anything about him before this, so.
Yeah, that excites me to hear.
He should have been more known.
Yeah, he's the sort of king who you'll mention him to someone and they will have no idea. But he does a lot.
It's like, you should know. Yeah.
And we could definitely thank Suger for that entirely.
Yes.
Because...
Thank you.
Yeah, you want to have a good church rider. In the same way that Robert II had Elgord, his chaplain, writing his whole life story.
Mm.
We've got that, but even better for Louis.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of historians who were like, oh, he was actually pretty similar to his father, Philip. But he just has this guy going on and on about how great he is. When that really... helps. He doesn't have any great battle. He doesn't have any great huge thing, but he was generally good. I think we can agree.
Yeah, like, he seemed like people liked him.
Which leads us into En Garde, of course.
Yeah.
En Garde.
So up to Louis VI, we have seen time and time again that while the king's authority isn't outright denied by the nobles, they certainly took advantage of his lack of military and judicial strength.
Yeah, or questioned him.
Not necessarily questioned him, just did their own thing and just assumed the king couldn't do anything about it, which was the case.
Like a puppet.
King. Not a puppet, but just like a guy who had his own territory. Like, the king has his territory, I've got my territory. I recognize he's the king.
Don't interfere.
But I do what I want. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Louis is widely considered to be the first really strong king of France since the death of Charlemagne back in 814.
Yeah, yeah.
So 300 years we've had of declining kingly power. And now finally Louis is...
Come back.
Making a comeback. So Victorian writer Charlotte Mary Young, who we met last episode, she had a scathing review of King Philip. But she calls Louis, quote, the most able man whom the line of Hugh Capet had produced since it mounted the throne.
Damn, that's solid.
Suger writes that Louis was very good at attracting skilled and loyal fighters to his armies.
That's good.
As we saw, he's very good at assembling men together.
Quick, yeah. Well, it shows, though, that people do...
respect him,
want to follow him in terms... Yeah, they respect him enough. Or fear him enough to be like...
Yeah.
Quick.
Throughout his reign, Louis fought and confiscated land from rebellious lords like Thomas of Marl.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few setbacks, like he didn't win every conflict.
Yeah, but come on.
Yeah. Of course, we have the Battle of Bremuel. He has a lot more trouble with England, and we had him sort of winning, but not really in Flanders. Sort of winning, but not really against Tybalt the Great.
The Emperor.
Yeah. So no enemy is ever fully dealt with. As we've seen a lot. But, you know, he's still expanding the royal domain. He's centralizing power within that little territory he does have. Not losing land. He does a lot of demolishing castles, actually. Because basically he'll go, he'll seize a noble's land. And if he doesn't have enough men, or if he doesn't have enough resources to actually, like...
Maintain
the castle himself, he'll just demolish it.
That's smart.
Yeah. So either, like, he's getting the castle, or he's just destroying the castle. Exactly. So Louis VI didn't just expand influence within his domain. He also did some meddling in the affairs of the magnates. For example, in the 1120s, he makes war on the powerful Aquitanian Count William VI of Auvergne, when William deposed Bishop Amory of Clermont, who then fled to the king, asking for help.
Yeah.
So not only on a local level, but also on a wider France level, Louis is intervening on behalf of the clergy.
People.
And that's usually his justification for bringing people down. We do see the church's power increasing quite a lot. In case you haven't noticed, most of the people around the king as chancellors and stuff are churchmen.
Yeah.
Suger,
yeah,
Stephen de Garlande, and Ivo. Just to name a few. But Louis really works with the church, you know.
Yeah.
It's making things run a lot more smoothly. It's argued as to whether, like, he's driving things or these churchmen driving things. I think maybe it's a mix of both.
Bit of both.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you can tell that Louis, like, dedicated, like, come on, even when he was, like, dying, he was still, like, doing stuff.
As we've said, he's not a puppet.
Yeah.
So in terms of other relations with other lords, he maintained a good alliance with his cousins, the Capetians in Vermandois and Burgundy. So that those borders are quite secure. Ralph of Vermandois, his cousin, even comes and helps him against the local Castellans. So that's good.
Oh, that's good.
Anjou was fairly dependable vassal in the early reign. Anjou becomes a bit more problematic later on when Geoffrey Plantagenet marries Matilda. And at the end of his reign, Louis actually sides with Stephen in the English anarchy, which causes a bit of problems. Actually, Louis goes back and forth actually quite a bit. Whenever England has like a civil conflict, Louis is like, I'll support one, then I'll support the other one, then I'll support the other one.
Make it fun.
Which is really, I think that's kind of good for En Garde, because he's playing both sides. He's using his enemy's power against it. But of course, as much as he's able to survive against England, England is still steadily increasing its power under Henry I.
Yeah.
And Louis isn't really able to do much about that. He loses the Battle of Bremuel. He barely stops England from taking over the Vexin.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's not good. The triumphs of Louis's reign were definitely exaggerated by Suger and later generations of French authors. However, he definitely built really well on the groundwork Philip I laid. As we've seen, the pendulum's going up the other way. Not least because he had a stronger character than his father. I think we can agree at least on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's on guard. What do we want to give him?
Kind of something like in the middle.
Yeah, it's definitely above 5 for me. Because it is the king increasing his power and authority quite a lot. There's quite a big leap.
Yeah, true. I think I was just so focused on England.
And the fact he's so active, like, even 10 years before his reign, that he's basically ruling France.
Even when he's dying, he's still active.
Because the, I guess, part of on guard is, you know, does he make great conquests outside his kingdom? Like, he's not doing that. But the other part of on guard is, like, how well does he seize power? How well does he hold on to power?
And he's doing that well.
The king's authority. Yes. He's definitely...
Like, there's no, like, major civil wars or anything going on.
I mean, there are major civil wars going on.
Yeah, I don't really count England and...
Blah.
France as civil war, though.
But his...
All right, forgot about
that. I mean, he's got a constant civil war going on with the Castellans, you could argue. True, I mean, it's...
That's, like, a minor one.
How are you defining civil war? Because it's not really a...
Big... Full on.
It's a hard thing to define in this period, like, because everyone's kind of constantly at war.
They're like the entire kingdom descending into madness.
Do you mean like two competing kings of France sort of thing?
No, just like big battles, lots of battles, burning of battles.
Well, there is a lot of that.
Well, there is a lot of burning.
But it generally works out in Louis's favor.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll see in Bolivia that there are also a lot of good things happening, despite the burning. But what do we want to give for on guard?
Thinking maybe like a 6. A 5, 6.
5 or 6. You gave Philip 5.5.
And I'll give Louis a 6.
You'd be giving him... Okay. 6.5 is the same as Robert II. Which I would argue he does better than Robert the Second. Everyone has battles, Eliza.
Yeah, but Robert's battles look cooler.
What were his cooler about his battles?
He died in battle, wasn't that?
No, that's Robert the First.
Oh, then I don't remember.
Robert the Second was Robert the Wise, with all of the divorces.
I thought that was Philip.
Philip also had.
Is Robert the one that got excommunicated?
Yeah, Robert was the first one who got excommunicated.
Oh,
he's not known for many battles, but he generally increased the royal authority. So he got a 6.5.
Okay,
from
you. Then he's better than that. Okay, I'll give him a 7 then.
Going to be less harsh as usual, and I'm going to give him an 8 because I just think he just makes such a big leap forward in terms of royal authority.
Okay.
And I think I have a sweet spot for him because of Suger, because I like Suger.
I have a sweet spot. I'm just a bit more harsh.
So that is a 7 and 8, which is a 15 for on guard.
Not too shabby.
Not too shabby. So let's move on to Voulez-vous.
Voulez-vous?
Louis is not exactly a heroic or chivalrous figure. Not generally seen as very heroic, inspiring.
Lionheart.
He's more depicted as like a greedy land grabber, mostly defined by internal little skirmishes. Even his great inspiring moment, the raising of the Oriflamme, was for a war that never happened. So we've got some criticism. I'll just get the criticisms out of the way first. They mostly come from other chroniclers other than Suger. So Guibert of Nogent criticizes Louis VI for being greedy and seizing land, though Guibert kind of says that about all the kings.
And what king doesn't do that?
Yeah, exactly.
Well?
Anglo-Norman chronicler William of Malmesbury describes Louis as, quote, changeable, though this is mostly referring to his relations with the English, which we described as a good thing in On Guard.
And which French person isn't, like, which French king isn't like that?
Exactly.
England?
But we've got plenty of good things about Louis's rule, not least the flood of praise coming from Suger, who says, as a distinguished and courageous defender of his father's kingdom, Louis provided for the needs of churches and, unusual for these days, worked for the peace of monks, labourers, and the poor.
Well, he does seem to uphold justice, because didn't that one, like, bishop go to him?
Yeah. He's basically, like, putting a muzzle on his more problematic vassals, For example,
that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, he made a rule for the Castellans that you can't build a castle without the king's permission in the royal domain, which is kind of a no-brainer.
But obviously some people didn't have a brain.
Exactly. He increases stability. He limits the abilities of these knights and lords to literally get away with murder and, you know, rape and arson and all the other horrible things they do. Louis was also not afraid to intervene in conflicts outside the royal domain, especially when a lord violated the church in some way, as we've seen with Auvergne. Mm. And he obviously gets a glowing review from Suger as well in terms of just church treatment in general. He's the first king to not get absolutely slogged by the church since Robert II.
They do seem to generally seem to like him, like the popes at least. No excommunications going on.
Yeah, I mean, it helps that he's being compared to the emperor, who is absolutely horrible to the popes. It's a low bar.
So the pope's like, he's better than someone.
He's kind of got a win-win situation where he's like, he's quite fun and debauched in his personal life. But he's not letting that bleed into his professional life or his dealings with the church.
Yeah, he can separate it.
He separated it. So he's well behaved without losing his edge, is Louis.
Like, he knows what to be like, depending on the situation.
So, yeah, he's quite severe and harsh and violent when it comes to punishing the church's enemies. But when it comes to actually dealing with the church, he's like, not going to punish anyone here. Bit of a drawback of Louis's character. Towards the end of his reign, he starts to show a rather paranoid streak.
Well, who wouldn't when they're dying?
Well, I think this is sort of after Blessed Charles the Good of Denmark gets assassinated. So,
yeah, I think anyone would get a bit paranoid.
Maybe on his mind a bit.
So,
fearful of the secret factions among his chamberlains and serving men, King Louis often changed his bed and increased the number of armed guards who kept watch over him for his nightly alarms.
What do you mean changed his bed? Like the mattress?
Like slept somewhere else.
Oh,
so he'd be sleeping in a different place each night so people couldn't keep track of where he was.
No assassination.
Yeah, no, he doesn't change his bed sheets. Got a servant for that.
Yeah, I was thinking poison in the mattress.
He ordered that his shield and sword should always be laid beside him as he slept. There was a certain close friend of the king who had been enriched by the royal liberality and was well known for his power, but was to be better known for his treason. When he was caught plotting, he was condemned to lose his eyes and genitals. A merciful punishment, for he deserved to be hanged. This is Suja's bloodthirstiness again.
He's plotting against the king?
Yeah. Through these and other plots, the king enjoyed no security, and renowned though he was for magnanimity and courage, he became prudent in small matters. So he's basically micromanaging his safety.
Paranoia.
Bit paranoid.
But justified.
Even in his house, he wore his sword and forbade his more faithful servants to leave their houses without their swords on pain of a fine, like a forfeit at play.
I think that kind of makes sense, though. You never know when someone's going to attack you.
Yeah. But he's even telling his servants,
even
like,
in your own home.
Yeah, he's telling his servants as well, like, you should be paranoid as well. We'll go everywhere with the sword, but not near me.
Take a step back from me.
So yeah, that's a slight negative for Voulez-Vous. He's a bit touchy to be around.
I feel so if a king isn't a bit paranoid, then are you really king?
You're not doing a good job if you're not constantly afraid someone's gonna stab you.
Yeah.
So in Louis's reign, on the most positive note, ending in Voulez-Vous, we see the beginnings of the 12th century Renaissance, which is a flourishing of art, culture, and learning. Peter Abelard and Eloise d'Argenteuil are writing their love letters and philosophical tracts during his reign. More about them in our Valentine's Day episode, which Eliza did some research for. Louis VI actually harbored Abelard at one point, protecting him from the church, though he was unable to stop the church from eventually castrating him.
No, it was the uncle. Well, he was, I guess, part of the church, but it was more the uncle just doing, you know, revenge.
But it was was a sentence. It was a legal sentence. He was sentenced to get castrated.
Oh, yeah. Well, Abelard always bloody got excommunicated, like, every other day, it seemed. He got excommunicated, like, multiple times.
But Louis sees the value of scholars like Abelard, so he's harboring him and protecting him in certain ways.
Which is interesting, because everyone was like, he's illiterate, so, but he's still aware.
Yeah, he at least values this stuff. I mean, he's best friends with Suger.
He understands.
So, he's best friends with a scholar. He can get along with different people.
Yeah, just good as a king.
Yeah, the Song of Roland was popularized during Louis VI's reign. The troubadours aren't quite a thing yet, but they are certainly born as a result of this renaissance. Louis VI also sponsored a collection of schools in Paris that would eventually become the University of Paris a couple decades after his death.
Oh, wow. Who are the troubadours again?
Troubadours like traveling bards and song composers.
Yeah, I knew the name, but I just mentally forgot what they were.
We'll learn all about them in Eleanor of Aquitaine's episode.
Yeah.
So Louis also recognized the economic changes that were happening in his kingdom. So in his reign, we start to see urban charters. So to more efficiently tax merchants and shopkeepers in cities.
That's good.
They're all benefiting from the recent population boom, thanks to less political chaos and a string of good harvests.
More time to have fun.
So France is becoming populated and prosperous in Louis's reign.
Whee!
A lot of this is also thanks to stability that we found in Philip's reign.
Yeah.
But Louis, you know, not doing anything to upset it. Making some more strides forward. The extent of these privileges for cities definitely depended heavily on how loyal you were, though. So Louis did play favourites.
I don't think you should award people who aren't loyal.
Yeah, exactly. So once the city of Lens lost its status as a protected commune because a bunch of rioters murdered the local bishop.
Well, that's understandable.
Pretty understandable. This bishop was apparently hiding from them in a barrel of wine, and when they opened it, they split his skull open with an axe so that the blood and wine mingled together. Bit more gruesome detail for you
there. I wonder if he drank some of that wine.
Who?
The bishop. He's like...
I don't know how well people can imbibe things when their skull is split in half.
Well, I meant before when he was hiding in the wine.
Oh, definitely. There's a reason he picked that barrel.
A little sip. It was his favourite vintage.
Isn't there a scene in Robin Hood when this one of the characters hides in a barrel and then gets drunk?
Yeah, the snake.
Yeah, the snake.
I just remember it hiccuping.
So that's Voulez-Vous. Ending on a slightly gruesome note, because Louis's reign was known for its gruesome executions. Although that particular one wasn't his fault.
Gruesome creative, I guess.
Yeah. What do we want to give for Voulez-Vous?
Thinking like 6 or 7.
Yeah. There's a lot of... It's a very 60-70 reign, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because he's doing a lot of good stuff. But you know what? I think this is getting into great reform territory. So I'm tempted to approach 8. Maybe not an 8, but approach. Maybe a
7.5. I'm going to go 6.5. Actually, no, I'll go 7.
We gave Hugh Capet a 7, and there weren't any great reforms in his reign. Whereas now we have like a full on renaissance kicking off. I think it's I think it's above Hugh Capet, so I'm I'll give you an 8.
7.5, fine. That's my final offer.
Is that your final score?
Yep, that's my final offer.
All right. 7.5.
Lock it in.
So that is a 15.5 for Voulez-Vous.
Damn, he's not doing too shabby overall so far.
No.
But let's see how he goes. Ooh la la.
Ooh la la. Have you been keeping track of the ooh la la's? Because remember, I don't have any notes.
Okay, so we have the gruesome deaths of the for avenging Charles
that's
of
one
Denmark.
Thing.
We have the... No, it's not a scandal.
The womanizing, the gambling... general saucy,
but it was like
sauciness.
In moderation.
The scores of illegitimate children.
The divorce, because the wasn't really married, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. That's a bit of divorce, and it's caused by a lot of shenanigans going around in the royal court, which Louis was old enough by then to have agency in that.
Yeah.
He has a mistress that we know about, Mary of Bruyé.
Oh.
Who's a noble woman.
Oh, finally. Have we had a confirmed, mistress?
Not in a while.
We've had ones where it was...
Not in a while.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
And name, too.
Mary of Bruyé. Yeah. They had two illegitimate children, a son, William, and a daughter, Isabella.
Okay, that's gonna...
She's only really talked about because she was noble. I'm sure there were many, many common women he did stuff with. So what are we thinking for Lala? I'm trying to think of other stuff. he's very like he's very tricksy, cunning with his, especially with dealing with the English, switching sides all the time, breaking promises, doing a bit of backstabbing.
I'm thinking maybe six.
Six? Wow.
Maybe five.
Yeah, because there's no big scandal.
Yeah, I'm going to go five.
There's lots of little things that are like, ooh, spicy. But there's nothing.
They kind of add up, but it's not like, there's no like murdering your nephews. There's no poison.
He's got that edge, but he's.
There's just the paranoia.
Yeah, but he's not scandally. So I think five. I think I'd agree with five.
Yeah.
So that is a 10 for Ooh La La.
Just needed a bit more.
Let's go into V on Throne.
Yes.
The V on Throne.
How do you think he's going to go in this round?
Okay-ish, but I'm not sure about his legitimate children because we haven't really mentioned that. So, I know one died.
Yeah, we know one died. We know he had at least another one. I did say they had a lot of babies, he and Adelaide. Sorry.
Oh, I just thought legitimate, but I don't know how many babies actually survived.
Well, we'll get into it. So he reigned from his father Philip I's death on the 29th of July 1108 to his own death on the 1st of August 1137. So that's 29 years and 3 days.
Okay, not too bad.
Which is 5.42 points.
Okay.
Towards the Vion Throne score. Children, in 1104, he married Lucienne de Rochefort, which, you know, ended in divorce. Yeah. Three years later, and she was a child, so that was never consummated. No children. But then in 1115, he married Adelaide of Maurienne. And their children, they had Philip, the junior king, died falling off his horse, not dead. Counted. Louis the VII succeeded as King of France, married Eleanor of Aquitaine. Henry, who entered the church and became Archbishop of Reims and survived his father.
Keeping the family.
Then we've got Hugh, who sadly died young.
Oh.
Then we've got Robert, who survived. He became Count of Dreux.
Wow, he had loads of sons.
Yep. We'll get to how many sons. So Robert founded the House of Dreux, which is our third cadet branch of the Capetians. So they're branching all over the place.
Okay.
And the Dreux family would eventually end up ruling Brittany down the line. Then we've got Peter or Pierre. We've run out of family names. So now we've got to a Peter.
Yeah.
He gained his title through his wife, Elizabeth, Lady of Courtenay, and founded yet another Capetian branch, the House of Courtenay. So he survives. He goes on. What are you're thinking?
Okay. No, I was just thinking, two's dead, four's alive.
So Peter was child number six, but we've had two die.
Yeah, four so far. Okay.
Child number seven, we have the only known daughter of Louis the VI, only known legitimate daughter of Louis the VI, Constance, who ends up becoming the Countess of Toulouse through marriage.
Okay.
And lastly, we have a baby who was born after the death of the first child, Philip, and who was consequently named Philip. So this is Philip II. No, he lived. He was a baby.
Oh!
He was a baby when... he was still a baby when Louis the VI died, not long after.
When Louis VI died. Oh, okay.
He survives and he enters the church, becoming the Archdeacon of Paris.
Damn, he loads of surviving kids. Yeah.
So that's overall 8 children.
Six survived. Damn, that's really good. And then the scores of the illegitimate obviously don't count, but, you know.
Obviously don't count. So that's 6 children. That's 10.13 points towards the Vion Throne score. So it's a total Vion Throne score of 15.55.
Is that the highest amount of kids that survived so far?
I think we may have had one
Was there anyone else who had 6?
I think we may have had one with 7. But we haven't yet gotten to the person with the most kids.
Is that a while away?
No, not that long away, actually. Ooh. Not too long. He's got now the second highest Vion Throne score.
Who's the first?
First being last episode, Philip the... Philip the First. So... he's slightly above Charlemagne, is Louis the Fat.
Damn.
Yeah. So, that is the scores. You want to hear the total score?
Okay. Yes, let's see the...
Da-da-da-ling. That is a score of 72.
Damn!
Yeah.
Damn.
And...
Was that, like, second highest or something?
Yep. He's got 8 points more than Robert II, which means he's our new second place after Charlemagne.
Damn. What did Charlemagne get again?
80.
80.
So Charlemagne got 80. So that means Louis the Sixth is only 8 points behind Charlemagne.
If he'd only been a bit more scandalous.
If only been a bit more scandalous, he'd have, yeah.
He might have beat him. Damn.
Yeah. I mean, he actually got a higher ooh-la-la score than Charlemagne.
Mm.
Charlemagne got 8, he got 10. But it was more just the fact that he kept getting 7s and 8s, where Charlemagne was getting 9s and 10s. It's more that.
True.
So with True. That said, is he fascinating enough, entertaining enough, majestic and fabulous and irresistible enough to be released from our dungeon, to go through the Battle Royale Championship, and be spared the guillotine?
I want to give it to him. I want to spare him.
Yeah.
Something about him.
He better be thanking Sujet at the tournament.
I know. Sujet is going to get a special seat.
Sujet gets honorable seating.
Mention.
Yeah.
Or he gets to hold the spear for the jousting.
Yeah, he hands him the banner.
He's like, here you go.
From the cathedral. He hands him the oriflamme.
Yeah. Yes.
So that was Louis the Fat.
Damn.
100 times better than Charles the Fat.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Who I'd be surprised if you even remembered.
I remember he was German.
So Louis the Fat got 72. Charles the Fat got 27. Yeah. So invert it.
Opposites.
That's so funny.
Flip flop.
And Charles the Fat, obviously German. Louis the Sixth, very French. We're definitely French at this point. Yeah.
French.
So that he is in the tournament.
Woo!
Competing alongside his great grandfather Robert II and his great great grandfather Hugh Capet. So that's the third Capetian to enter the tournament.
Whee!
So the Capetians, they only have to get one more in the tournament, and then they'll be equal to the Carolingians in terms of tournament contenders, because the Carolingians only got 4.
How many Carolingians are 4?
How many Carolingians overall?
How many? So we're obviously Charlemagne.
Yes. Do you want me and to then... do you want me to just rattle them off instead of you guessing? Because we've done that so many times.
Yeah.
So, Pepin the Short, Charlemagne, Charles the Bald, Odo. Actually, Odo's not a Carolingian, so...
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't even...
No, I was wondering.
So, if you count Odo as a Capetian, because they are technically the same family, the Robertians and the Capetians have now overtaken the Carolingians.
Winning.
For most people. They've definitely got a higher average at this point. Their average is looking really good. We've had nobody below 30 yet.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, they really are. There's no
real duds. Henry I was a bit of a dud, but even he got above 30, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No do-nothings yet.
Nah. I don't think we're ever going to get a do-nothing king again, to be honest.
Oh, that's great.
We're going to have kings who are absolutely horrible and useless. But they'll be...
But we have stuff on them.
Well, they'll be doing things and that's the problem.
Oh, they're the meddling ones that you don't want. You're like, please just take a step back.
Please just go away.
You don't need to be involved.
Yeah.
So just take a holiday.
Yeah.
We don't need you here.
Exactly. So, that is the episode. Any final words?
Yes, tell us what you think.
Tell us what you think.
Do you agree with us? You know, check us out on all the socials as per usual.
Sign up to Patreon.
Check us out on Patreon if you want.
Yeah.
You know.
And that's it.
No pressure there, though.
No pressure there. So, next time, Eliza, I'm tossing up between whether to do Louis VII first or do Eleanor of Aquitaine first.
Ooh.
Because Eleanor of Aquitaine, in her episode, we would be covering the first part of Louis VII's reign anyway. So, I'm thinking, like, maybe we put her first as episode 34.5 rather than 35.5. We'll just be going over the same ground again.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Because for reasons that we'll get into, their paths sort of diverge.
Yeah. I wonder why.
Yeah.
What could happen?
So maybe it's better if we...
Where could she have gone?
So maybe it's better if we cover Eleanor first.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
And people do know a lot about her.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's decided. Next episode will be Eleanor of Aquitaine.
So, woo!
And then Louis the Seventh. And maybe since they're pretty concurrent, we can release them a week apart or something.
Yes.
Yeah. But we'll see you in 2 weeks, surprised. Either way.
Who knows?
Or hear you. Okay. You'll hear us. Something.
Yeah.
And sorry the Patreon's been a bit slow. We'll try to do something in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But,
Yeah.
Yeah. Just got I've had a lot of stuff to do.
We could always do Les Mis.
Always do who? What?
Les Mis.
Oh, Les Mis. I'll just randomly just ignore all the things that we said we've done and just do Les Mis.
Yeah.
No, we can't do Les Mis until we
It's just because I was watching it. Oh, right.
We can't do Les Mis until we get to that king who's around at that time.
Oh, okay.
Because it's important.
Yeah, sorry. I was just watching it.
So we will in a few years' time, we will do the historical context behind Les Mis, and then we'll talk about Les Mis on the Patreon.
Okay.
But until then, until 2 weeks from now, we'll do Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Can you do something not about Les Mis?
Eleanor of Aquitaine. It's going to be au revoir from me.
And goodbye from me.
I'm also at this stage, I'm thinking like, do I include the epithet in the name? Because everyone, at this stage, everyone has like a number and an epithet.
As long as we're not getting rid of epithets.
Yeah, no, we're not getting rid of it.
I thought that's what you meant and I was about to kill you.
We're still going to keep spending way too much time on epithets and etymologies.
Good, because if you got rid of those, I don't see what's the point of living anymore.
We spend so much time on etymology compared to,
others.
That's
what makes us amazing, okay?
But now Tsar Power is going to do an etymology for every king. Every new name.
See? They're us.
We're trendsetters. Well, they're... I know, especially... We're Roberto's favourite podcast, so...
I know, he uses my Eliza-ism.
Yeah, so we're his main inspiration, which is great.
Woo!
Feel very, very
I feel so powerful
that.
Knowing so someone powerful. Else is using my ism.
What was the ism again?
Well, memory of a jellyfish.
Memory of a jellyfish, yeah.